Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
White Oak Pastures is the only farm in the United States that has its own USDA-inspected red meat abattoir or slaughterhouse and its own USDA-inspected poultry abattoir or slaughterhouse. We partner with Whole Foods to deliver our high-quality meat and poultry from Miami, Florida, all the way to Princeton, New Jersey. One family, one farm, five generations, 145 years. A full circle return to sustainable land stewardship and humane animal stockmanship. For more information, please visit our website, whiteoakpastures.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Chef Story. I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton from the International Culinary Center in New York, and today I'm broadcasting from the Planters Inn in Charleston, South Carolina at the Charleston Food and Wine Festival, and I have one of the great chefs of Charleston with me, Michelle Weaver from the Charleston Place Hotel, and Michelle is a native of Alabama.
I am.
A real southerner, and she has taken this place by storm. The chairman of the Food and Wine Festival, my good friend Rick Giroux, told me you're one of his favorite chefs in the world.
Aww,
so I just want to know all about your story, and so tell me, so you're a native of the South?
Absolutely. I've had a great time living in the South. I spent two cold winters in Vermont.
Oh, really?
And the rest of the time,
school, right?
Yes. And the rest of the time, I've had the privilege of living in New Orleans and Nashville and now Charleston, so great cities.
So tell me, Michelle, about your background. What kind of town did you grow up in?
It's a small little town. It was about 55,000 people. We were the largest dry city in the nation up until like the mid-'80s. So we didn't have a lot of options as far as restaurants because you couldn't serve wine or beer or anything like that. So after that happened, though, it exploded. So now we have lots of restaurants when I go home to see my family.
So they rescinded, though.
Yeah. And they passed the law and finally got alcohol. So that made restaurants want to come in.
When did that happen?
It was probably 84, 85.
Oh, so. Okay. We'll get into that a little later. Okay, so... is your family a multi-generational family?
Well, in that area, yeah. From North Alabama.
North Alabama.
Yeah,
so
most people.
What's the name of the town?
It's called Decatur, Alabama.
Oh, Decatur. Okay.
You might know Decatur, Alabama, because of Witt's Barbecue, or not Witt's Barbecue, Big Bob Gitson Barbecue with the white sauce, which is a North Alabama barbecue
white sauce.
White
sauce, is that a vinegar?
It is vinegar. Vinegar mayonnaise base, which people, that's our little secret in North Alabama.
That sounds like coleslaw.
Well, it kind of is. It's like apple cider vinegar and a little cayenne and black pepper and mayonnaise and vinegar, and then you add it to chicken. So it's what we put, barbecue sauce for chicken.
Oh, for chicken. That sounds great.
So it's called
Alabama
white sauce. I do, too.
So tell me, what are your earliest memories of food?
Probably cooking with my mom, pulling up a chair with her at the stove, a cast iron skillet, and whatever's fresh from her garden. That's the way we grew up. So.
You know, I am just so jealous. So many of the chefs I've talked to down here are just people. They really have a connection to the land. It seems most people do have gardening. You know, up north, maybe because we have such a short season and we live in
right.
such big cities, we've become so disconnected from the land. So tell me about the garden and tell me what kind of foods your mom made.
Well, for us, it was a necessity. That's how she fed us. We didn't grow up, without a lot. Mm-hmm. We never knew we were poor, but we always had food, mostly vegetables or little hoe cakes or some kind of seasoning. It's like a little fried cornbread.
Oh,
you know, you do it in a cast iron skillet,
remember,
like you do a pancake.
I'm sorry. thank you for allowing me, in your city here. But a lot of our listeners out there all over the world, so yeah. We can't use the shorthand. I'm going to be asking you what these names
are.
Good.
But my mother still grows a garden every year. Mm-hmm. She preserves, she cans, you know, just like she was going to starve to death over the winter if they didn't put up the vegetables, you know, and then distribute it throughout the family, you know.
So now, you know, canning is, I thought, becoming a lost art because people freeze
really
and things like that.
It really
that.
Is.
What kind of things would she can? What kind of things do you like eating out of a can?
Oh, gosh, she cans everything. I mean, from beans to okra.
This means putting
them
in a mason jar.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And she pickles things. She makes preserves and jams. And, you know, as things come into season, she won't leave her little farm, her little area, because things are coming in. She's like, I can't go anywhere. The garden's coming in.
Right. You got to
that's what she said. Put it up. You got to put up everything. So she puts tomatoes up so she can make tomato sauces during the winters. Mm-hmm. But she cans everything.
Well, I'll tell you what we're doing right now. I don't think you're doing that. Because I put up a lot of things, too. I had a Czechoslovakian grandmother that taught me a lot. We're making maple syrup.
Oh.
We're tapping our trees. So, okay.
Very nice.
So what were some of the dishes your mom made that you just loved?
Well, my favorite of hers for the put-up stuff was her homemade vegetable soup. Because everything was fresh from the garden at its peak flavor, and then she canned it. And so in the winter, you'd make a big pan of cornbread and pull out some vegetable soup. She would send us this when I was in culinary school in Vermont or my brother off at school, whatever.
How did she make it?
I don't know. I mean, she didn't even use stock. It was just vegetables cooked in all this water with herbs and different things, and it just tastes like vegetables. Green beans tasted like green beans. The tomatoes tasted like tomatoes in their peak season. So it was just very simple, but it was perfect.
I want the recipe. You're going to ask her.
I don't think she wouldn't give you a recipe. She doesn't use recipes.
Oh, she doesn't use recipes.
No.
So she just put them. So she was very intuitive. Was that passed along?
Probably one of the best Southern cooks I've. You know, she grew up from her grandmother learning how to do these things, and her sisters can't cook a lick. But she inherited that gene. No.
And so did you.
No.
Are you lucky?
Well, she was
what
inspired me. Yeah. So that's how I learned to cook, was that cast iron skillet.
So at what age did you start thinking about being a chef?
You know, it wasn't until probably my mid to late 20s. I'd been in the food industry for a long time, and working the front of the house, waiting tables, bartending. I was putting myself through college and different things. Came home, kept going back to the business. Mm-hmm. And a friend of mine went to culinary school and came back and opened a restaurant. And I was like, why haven't I done this? Why aren't I doing this? Mm. This is what I really want to do.
Mm. So, what age was that when you decided to do that?
I was probably 26, 27.
Mm. So
I got a late start.
Back to school?
Absolutely, but exciting at the same time. Mm. You know, I put everything I could in my little red Cavalier, headed to Vermont. It's a 2-day trip there.
How'd you choose the school? Because it was so far away.
It was. And, you had this great little quaint picture of Vermont in your mind, which was truly that until, winter came.
Yes, right. Well, they do
snow-covered
pictures, too, The steeple is the only thing you see under the snow, snow.
Well, my thinking was, though, I felt like I was getting a late start on this. Mm-hmm. You know, as much as I was, doing catering and working the front of the house, I knew what the business was. Mm-hmm. But at this age, I was, starting over again. And so I really wanted to be in a place where I could get the biggest bang for my buck, if I'm going to have to invest again, because a couple of your schools are very expensive.
Right.
And so I looked at Vermont, it's 7-to-1, teachers, it's all hands-on, and I was like, I don't want to be in a demo class, I don't want to be in an auditorium talking about food, I want my hands in the food. Mm. And so I thought this was really the best place I could be. Mm. And so I packed up, and the first 12 hours, I'm driving, I'm like the window's down, the radio's crank. I'm like, woo, this is going to be great, you know. And then the second leg of the trip, I'm like, oh, my God, I'm 24 hours away from anybody that I know and love. I'm gonna, what am I doing? And then I get there, and I was like, this is exactly where I'm supposed to be.
Oh. So
it worked out great.
Wow. So tell me, what's the difference between a great home cook and a professional chef?
Well, I mean, think of it this way. I mean, have you ever tried cooking for 30 people all ordering something different out of your house?
No.
That's it. Yeah. So it's that kind of thinking, you know, I was like, I don't want to do that. It was one thing to make a big pan of lasagna and a salad.
Right.
Well, I don't want salad. I want, you know, something else. I want soup. I want, you know, steak. I want da 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 da.
So what's the key to doing all that?
Having a great team to back you up, you know.
Yeah. But what if you only got two or three in the kitchen?
Well, I've come through kitchens. I mean, yeah. You know, I'm in a hotel kitchen now, but, you know, I came through small independent restaurants. You know, there was only two of us in there. It's usually the chef, you and maybe a dishwasher.
You got to have octopus arms, right? All front and back and
it's
all
that,
over.
You know, like you get in that groove of working together and reading each other's minds and, you know, just keep
so
it
So what
flowing.
Was your dream in culinary school? What were you dreaming about? Is this your, you know, coming back to the South?
It's hard to explain. It's like I feel blessed every day that I actually get to do what I love to do, mm-hmm. to make a living. Mm-hmm. You know, like I said, I didn't even occur to me somehow till my mid-20s that, holy moly, I could really do this mm-hmm. as a job? Are you kidding me? You know, I don't know why it never dawned on me. You know, my folks just came up working, hardworking people.
Mm-hmm.
My mom was a nurse, or still is a nurse. My dad's retired now, and he, you know, he owned his own businesses and different things, and he's semi-retired now. But they, you know, work for other people or, you know, try to be a small business.
And, do you have siblings?
Oh, yes.
Any of them have the bug of cooking?
Not professionally, but everybody loves food and everybody loves to cook. You know, I have the brother youngest from me. He's the grill master. He can cook the best brisket I've ever had in my life. He'll cook it for 18, 20 hours, get up in the middle of the night to baby it. You know, he only does it like twice a year because it's such a pain for him. Mm. But it's absolutely delicious.
Mm.
And then my other brother, he's the wine enthusiast. Huh? He loves wine.
Always got to have one of those in the
absolutely.
Family.
So he brings the wine and picks the wines for whatever dinners we're going to do. And then my sister, who's an artist in Baton Rouge, she's a vegetarian. And she loves food. And she, you know, in her travels to, you know, Indonesia or different places, she'll bring back all these great flavors. So she's really open to the global.
They show you any difference in the kitchen? Like when you're cooking, do they say, okay, we defer to you. We'll do it your way.
Well, it's automatically, or you're cooking, right? Yes, unless it's the brisket.
Yeah, right. So tell me, you know, when you were young, did you consider anything? Well, obviously, you said you came to this late. So, what did you think you were going to be? And what were some of your other passions?
Well, I was going to be a marketing director of some sort. I think, you know, that's what I went to school for. But I kept coming back to food and beverage. I loved it so much.
Mm.
You know, and I was like, oh, okay, I'm not really wanting to do this. And I'd start back in another restaurant and just have the best time.
So you went from Decatur to Vermont?
No, I went from Decatur to, Alabama. And
okay.
Then I came back home.
University of Alabama?
Yes, and then I came back home
after
that.
Did you eat at the Highland Grill at all?
Where?
At the Highland Grill?
Oh, well, Frank Sin, of course.
Yeah.
Are you kidding me?
Isn't the University of Alabama there?
Well, he's in Birmingham. In Tuscaloosa at the university. But, you know, I grew up knowing who Frank was. Well, Frank was one of my idols, you know, when he opened the Highlands Bar and Grill. And still is, you know.
Yeah.
It's always a treat to see him when he comes into town for the festival.
Yeah.
But, you know, that was for me, the epitome of fine dining growing up, you know, was...
It still is.
You know, I adore him and I adore his food. And
he's an incredible inspiration to lots of the younger chefs coming up. I guess I had a big dinner here for him.
That's tonight.
Oh, it's
Saturday.
Tonight.
Yes,
cooking?
No, yeah. Not unfortunately.
No.
I couldn't be there. But
okay. It's
going to be a phenomenal dinner. Mm. Phenomenal.
I wish I could go. So tell me, when you were you know, you had a sense of becoming a chef, and when now you're actually a chef, what's the difference of being really being professional and, as opposed to being a good home cook?
Well, it's organized chaos. I mean, you know, 100 plus people coming to see you a night that you've got to organize an entire menu for because you don't know what they're going to order. So you got to have this team, and it has to be, you know, clockwork. It has to be passion in that food. Every single plate has got to be lift a spirit, make somebody smile, make them have an experience.
How hard is it to get your will through other people? Because you've got, how big is your team at Charleston?
It depends on what night, you know. So usually have at least 4 line cooks, you know, and myself.
So how do you get somebody else to make your food?
You have to work with them. You have to teach them. You know, just can't hand them a recipe because I don't think I don't like recipes because it doesn't impart that making people taste it, feeling it, you know, the texture, the flavor, the smell, you know, the happiness in that dish. So you really have to work. Every single dish that we change, I have everybody work that dish with me. So I show them how I want it done, and then I make them cook it for me right back. So I want you to taste what I'm cooking, and then I want you to turn around after I show you this dish and cook it back for me, and so let's taste it again.
So when you hire somebody, what are you looking for?
A, it has to be from the heart, passion. You know, there's a lot of easier ways to make a living than what we do. And being part of a hotel, we're open 365 days of the year. Holidays are some of the biggest days of the year. We work long, hard hours. You're going to spend more time with me than you are with your loved ones. So we've got to all get along. So no jerks, you know.
That's good.
But the enthusiasm first. You know, I can teach you the skills if you've got the desire to learn it. I can't teach you desire. You have to bring that to the table.
Right.
So it has to come from here.
So, actually, we're going to take a little break here, and then we're going to come back and talk about the set.
Great.
Welcome back. You're listening to Chef Story, and I'm Dorothy Cam Hamilton. And today we're broadcasting from Charleston, South Carolina, because we're down here for the Charleston Food and Wine Festival. And I have one of the greatest Charleston chefs with me, Michelle Weaver of the Charleston Grill at the Charleston Place Hotel. But you're in charge of all the food at the hotel, aren't
you? No, thank goodness.
No. Oh, all right. Because I was going to say, we had a nice breakfast, a room service breakfast there. I can heartily recommend it. But unfortunately, with this festival, it's very hard to get around and eat around town. We're eating so much. But let me ask you something about the South. Where do you... I'm discovering products that I never discovered before. For example, rice. And I think Alabama is one of the biggest rice producers in the country.
Actually, Charleston used to be.
Before
the war, that's why Charleston was one of the richest cities at that time. Mm-hmm. It all came from the rice. So most rice that's in the States now actually came from Charleston originally. It's now moved to Arkansas. It's a big rice state as well.
Oh, and Texas too, I think. Yeah. So what do you see rice as a southern ingredient in your dishes, or... How do you view rice?
More so since I've moved to Charleston from the coastal aspect of Low Country. It's a real big part of Low Country cuisine. Mixing seafood with the rice, you know, and obviously grits as well. But we call them rice grits.
What is that?
All right. Well, they're one of my favorite people in the world is Glenn Roberts from Anson Mills. Mm-hmm. And he is such an amazing man that he has done all this research. His mind is just crazy scientific. He was a chef at one time, and then he started trying to find all these old seeds and different things that have dissipated and disappeared. And he finds these patches or talks to these people and finds all these great little jewels of the South here, you know. And so he started growing the Carolina gold rice again. It was a little heirloom. Started bringing it back. And he calls them rice crisps. They're the broken pieces because they're a soft rice. Once they get milled, they break into these little pieces. Uh-huh. And so they look like grits, but they're rice.
I see.
But he's also found like this patch of sea allen red peas, you know, that everybody thought
was
gone.
Pea?
It's just like, it looks like a little field pea. It's a little brown pea. They're delicious. But he finds all these great treats. And so for us as chefs, I mean, these guys and their passion is driving to find all these little lost jewels. Mm-hmm. And bringing them back and growing them and harvesting them, because it's not easy. Mm-hmm. You know, the mast milled rice is a lot easier than getting in a truck by yourself, you know, in waders.
Oh, sure, you can too. It's
a lot of work.
So tell me, how's the raw products, the food products, different in Alabama from Charleston?
Well, it depends on where you go. I mean, there's a lot of great farms coming up all over the South, and probably everywhere now. Everybody's moving to that farm to table, or you know, I always get perturbed with that phrase, because you know, any chef worth their weight has always been, you know, doing that. You know, you wanted the local, you wanted the fresh. But what has made it great is there are more people farming that way now. I think that was a lost art, like we talked about before, about preserving. It just became all manufactured farms. So now you've got these great little farms and whole families. You know, we have this great Ambrose family that we work with a lot that have grown, and now they grow things and stagger crops. We can have things longer.
Are they local?
Yes.
Right outside of Charleston?
Yes.
What kind of foods do they make?
Right now I'm still getting tomatoes, fresh local tomatoes, little cherries.
What do you mean you're still getting? Did they have them through the winter?
We've had them. We had a 2-week span we couldn't get them. And, you know, we've had a great mild winter. That has a lot to do with it. First strawberries just showing up this week.
Really?
You know, it's been awesome.
It's March 2nd, folks, here.
But there's been a great transition. Like, you know, I moved here 15 and a half years ago. And we had great farms, but most everybody was doing the same thing. And it was like you know, you'd have asparagus for 2 weeks and that was it. You would have collard greens coming out your ears or eggplant. But that's all anyone was growing. So now, working with more chefs, more restaurants, more people coming to Charleston, we've got more farms and people growing and doing things.
How does that work? Are these mid-sized farms? And
some of them
work with a farmer and say, this is what I would like you to grow?
A lot of it is that. And that part of the education, because maybe they've only grown collards all of their life. Mm-hmm. But they want to make us happy because they want to sell their products.
Right.
But there's only so many collards we can buy at a time.
Right.
But if you can do this and stagger it, where not everybody's got asparagus, you know, the first 2 weeks of April.
Right.
You know, we can have it staggered out a little bit and carry us through maybe a month or two. Mm-hmm. Then we can keep buying from you. So it's a partnership. Mm-hmm. It truly is a partnership.
What about dairy? Do they have any special milk farms here?
We're starting to get, yes, we do have a couple small farms doing that, and she's doing a great job with that, mm-hmm. Celeste Albers. Beautiful milk, unpasteurized, and they do eggs. We've got, you know, 3 or 4 people doing, you know, local eggs now that can supply most of the restaurants if you want it. Mm-hmm. We've even got monks, you know, living, you're doing oyster mushrooms for us and shiitake mushrooms.
Really?
Yeah.
How does that work? I mean, do they just forage for them, or do they...
They cultivate
kind of
those.
Cultivate
those are cultivated.
They're cultivated.
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting.
So everybody's in on it.
Everybody. Yeah, no, it's a very organic system.
Yes,
there.
Yeah.
So what about, you know, in Charleston, what is the Southern eater looking for? I notice the sugar quotient is quite high. This morning, there was a special breakfast at High Cotton, and they had this dish ambrosia there. And it was like, wow, it was like an insulin shot or something. And, you know, I was like, oh, that's why these people are so happy in the morning. You know, tell me about the sugar level in the South. Is there, you know, it's much
well,
much
ever,
sweeter
yeah.
here, aren't they?
You know, we're big fans of sweet iced tea around here.
Right,
so.
Right. Where did that come from? Do you know?
I don't know. I know that, you know, I like tea both ways, but I usually have to, if I have a glass of ice, sweet tea, I'm usually pouring about half unsweet, half sweet in there because it's a little too much for me. So.
But even the cakes. Now, I've had a couple of cakes down here, and they're absolutely delicious. I think layer cakes are from the South, aren't they? Or,
maybe.
Probably from
maybe.
England, I think, and yeah. came over, and then they were really... But, you know, I was just wondering, with the lack of alcohol, you know, which there are, you know, a lot
right,
of dry
right.
places in the South. Did you think that had anything
maybe,
to do with the,
maybe,
maybe.
If we can't have the booze, well, I'll take the sugar.
All right. Okay, we're not going down the history. I had the Lee brothers here, and they were all about... history, and then some people know the whole genetic history of a pea, but all right, you know what, we're going to take another short break, and when we come back, we're going to continue with Michelle Weaver. Welcome back. You're listening to Chef Story, and I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton. And today we're in Charleston talking to Michelle Weaver from the Charleston Place Hotel, and she's the commander of the Charleston Grill there. So, Michelle, I'm going to talk to you about women chefs. I don't know if this is a popular topic that people bring up with you all the time.
It is, but, you know, it's just one of those, it's like, you know, you never want to be singled out because you're a woman. You want to be singled out because you're a great chef.
Right.
You know, you want to be taken seriously just like the guys are.
Right.
And sometimes I think people put an emphasis on just being a woman chef because there's so few of us.
Right.
You know.
But so why are there so few women chefs?
You know, I can't answer that for everybody. I know that it's tough balance. You know, I made the decision a long time ago that, you know, I wasn't going to have children. So, you know, I couldn't do what I'm doing right now, I know personally, and have children because I'm so exhausted. You know, 12, 14, 16-hour days, it leaves no time for a child. I don't even have a dog because I feel guilty of leaving a dog at home that long.
Really? I mean,
you know, so, but this is, these kids at the restaurant are my kids. You know, that's the way I look at it. And they are my family, too, and so that's where I put my energy because I would be miserable. I would not be myself if I didn't have this. Mm. I just believe in it so much, and I believe in giving back to these kids and teaching them if this is what they want to do, and seeing people smile every night, you know, and it's that instant gratification going through the dining room. But I can't make that decision for everyone as far as a woman's concerned. I know some great women chefs that have children and have families, and I support them 100%. I just couldn't see myself doing it.
Doing that. Did you ever feel
I felt like something
would
be...
Yeah.
You know...
Compromised.
It would be, yeah.
So, did you ever feel a glass ceiling? Did you ever feel like you couldn't progress as far as you wanted? Or if you wanted your own restaurant, mm-hmm. do you think it would be equally easy for you to get financing for it? Did you ever feel any...
You know,
challenge?
Yes, probably starting out a little bit. You know, you being the only woman at times when, you know, you're starting out as a line cook and probably having to work three times as hard to get noticed or anything to get ahead. You know, that was tough.
What about the women that come to your kitchen now? Are there a lot more women coming through the kitchen?
Not as many as I would hope, you know?
What percentage of your staff?
Well, we hired some new staff right now, but at one point, you know, I've had opportunities where I've had 50-50, which was a great yin and yang in the kitchen. It was awesome. Right now I have three women that work for me and probably seven men. Mm. So right now it's a little...
Do you think women give a different style in the kitchen? Energy. I don't mean, you know, cooking style. Is there a different
absolutely.
Energy? How do you describe that?
More detailed.
Really?
It was like they can see the detail and the whole picture as opposed to just, you know, minds are da-da-da-da-da-da that fast. But yeah, it's all about the detail. And they say a little bit more calm, to be honest. I mean, most of the
that's what I've heard, you know, is that there is just not as much testosterone dripping off the walls.
It's not as competitive.
Yeah.
That opportunity I told you about with, you know, it was half women, half men. It was like one of the most cohesive teams I'd ever worked with. You know, it was that balance of testosterone and detail and calmness. So, yeah, absolutely. I can definitely tell a difference when there's not as many women in my kitchen. You know, the testosterone gets higher, the competitiveness gets higher, the
that all kind
boisterousness.
Of, right. Do you think there's a difference in menu? Do you think that you can tell the gender of a chef by looking at a menu?
I've never thought about it, to be honest. I think people have remarked to me about that.
Oh, what have they said?
Well, I tend to go for fresh and bright and light flavors, you know. And I get bored with, you know, two bites of something if it's not changing or if it's just too much of something. So I like food that has complexity to it, but subtle, you know. So as you're eating, you're going, wow, that wasn't in that first bite. You know, now it's changing into something else. You just really get into it. Where sometimes, you know, the guy's food will just comes right off the bat. Boom, you know, it hits you, and that's all you get, though.
depending where you are. So tell me more about your food. When you compose a menu, what are some of the basic rules you have about putting together a menu? Do you change your menu seasonally?
Absolutely,
okay.
Absolutely.
So what's the first thing, how do you compose?
Well, I don't know if you've seen my menu. My menu is kind of like four mini menus. So, you know, how a lot of restaurants is just one style of food. We have the opportunity to, we have a southern side. We have a cosmopolitan side, which is like global flavors. I have a lush side, which is kind of my French background and growing. And then just pure and simple. So we get to play with a lot of products, and which is exciting because I think a lot of times chefs can get stuck in a rut by cooking the same style of food over and over. Hmm. It all begins to taste the same.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with the cosmopolitan aspect of the menu, it keeps you growing, it keeps you challenged, it keeps you experimenting. And looking for different flavors. And I really have to say, I mean, I've had so much fun with that side of the menu, and then you'll find it, you know, kind of incorporating itself throughout the menu. But, you know, discovering, you know, a new spice like asafoetida, you know, from India.
What's that? Here we go again. I mean,
it's a spice in Indian culture. And
Indian as in India.
Yes.
Okay.
And the nickname is called Devil's Dung.
Ooh!
So I was like,
how appetizing.
Right.
So what does it taste like?
Well, you smell it, you really don't want to taste it. But I was like, okay, that's apparently how it comes about with the nickname. But you add it to, like, you got potatoes in this oil, and you add it last minute, and all of a sudden it becomes really fragrant. And the taste is amazing. I mean, you just have to try it. I can't even explain it.
How did you discover it?
I was researching some Indian cuisine. We were doing a dinner for Darkness to Light. It was a charity at the thing. The whole thing was Indian. I said, well, I'm going to do an Indian dish then for this. So I started researching, and trying to find spices was almost nearly impossible at that point. And came across, kept seeing this word. I was like, started researching, what is asafoetida? And then we have this great little Indian grocery store that opened up. Her name is Nellie. It's like, Nellie, what is
asafoetida? Sounds like something Santana would play on the guitar, you know?
And then I brought it back and finally got some. I had to mail order it and get it in. She didn't even have it. And so we got it in. And we were at the event getting ready to cook with it. I was like, the first time. We didn't have time to, you know, just came that day. We didn't even have time to practice with it. It's like, here we go. So at the event, we're there. And my line cook that I had with me, his name was Jamie. He was like, Mama, he goes, you're going to have to do this. I'm afraid of this stuff. I was like, everybody was looking at me like, uh-oh, this is going to be really good or really bad. Thank God it was really good. So we went with it.
What are some of the your favorite dishes you're cooking right now?
Let's see. One of my favorite right now would be, we're doing a Thai fish dish.
Oh.
And we're
what
using...
What makes it Thai?
I'm doing, I call it Tom Yung Goon, which is a shrimp and lemongrass soup, but I'm using that as a broth, mm-hmm. and then to that I'm adding our fresh local cherry tomatoes, a little diced up haricot vert, grilled pineapple, Thai basil.
Grilled pineapple in the broth? Mm-hmm. Ooh, that must give it a smoky. Yeah.
And it has, you know, the broth itself is cooked with like dried shrimp and lemongrass and ginger and garlic and shrimp stock and chilies, and so it's got a balance of sweet and spicy, but still savory with that fish. Mm-hmm. Make a little scallion.
What kind of fish do you use?
Whatever's usually a snapper that's local. Mm-hmm. Whatever's coming in fresh that day with the skin on, and get the skin nice and crispy.
So you put that in the broth?
We sear off the fish, get the skin nice and crispy, and then we pour the broth around it. Mm-hmm. And then we make our own shrimp chips too. Had some fun.
That's good. Oh, that sounds delicious.
Yeah. You'll have to come and try.
I know. So, what kind of rice do you serve? Do you serve rice?
No rice.
Okay, so it's just the broth.
Right. We're doing a little side dish of on our Cosmopolitan side too of lobster fried rice. One of my sous chefs made it for a little bar I'm used one day, and I was like, "We're putting this on the menu." He was like, "Great."
Lobster, that sounds great.
That's really good.
Lobster. Do you use Carolina? Or do you use, Charleston rice? Or?
For this one, I'm using a basmati, but we use a lot.
That almost sounds treacherous in Charleston, right? not
we just needed that a little bit more. Mm-hmm. But yes, we've got some great rice that we use a lot.
So as a Yankee, I need some more education here.
All right.
So what is low country? I mean, you know, we keep talking about it. I kind of think, well, I guess it's not very high. I guess it's sea level. I don't know. Is that what low country, and how big is low country? Is it just Charleston?
It's the coastline, the eastern coastline of Georgia and South Carolina.
Okay, right, not North Carolina.
Right, no. You don't go past, like, Georgetown, and you don't go past Savannah, I think is the borders. But it is low country because it is below sea level.
Oh, it's below sea level.
We are below sea level here. And so the slightest little sprinkle can cause flooding here really easily. So it doesn't take much, especially if the tides are coming in.
Uh-huh.
So
I guess that gives you a whole, you know, set of different kinds of
You know, it's mostly seafood, you know, because we have a bounty right outside of our doors here, you know, crabs and clams and shrimp and great local fish. That's definitely low country, mixed with our, you know, rice especially, or grits, either one. So those are the main components of what could be considered low country. Mm-hmm. You've probably heard of she crab soup or Frogmore stew.
So what were the cultural influences of that? Do you know?
Charleston was a port city, you know, and that's a lot of influx from, you know, everywhere from the plantations from Barbados to bringing the slaves in. You know, the ochre came in with that. Mm-hmm. You have the French Huguenots. Mm-hmm. It's a real mix of mosh-posh here.
Yeah.
And so all those little influences influenced the cuisine, obviously, and as it grew and changed.
So, what do you think of peanuts and the boiled peanut
love them. Are you kidding me? They're awesome.
They are awesome. Are they only here?
No. I grew up in Alabama. We, you know, peanut farms there as well, yeah.
And do you boil them?
Oh, absolutely. We make hummus out of them. A boiled peanut hummus.
Really?
We do all kinds of stuff with them. Yeah, absolutely.
So, why don't you think this caught on in other areas of the country?
I'm not sure, but I don't know. We'll keep it down here. We don't mind that.
I like it. I was driving from here to Savannah, and there was a little gas station. And
you can get them anywhere, yeah.
And, you know, I thought it was hot soup, and I picked up this thing, and I see these peanuts. Never had them before, and I put them, and I was just addicted, you know. And
can't stop eating them.
No, you can't stop eating them. And they're very nutritious, right?
Absolutely.
I think that...
They're legumes. I mean, peanuts are really legumes.
Legumes, yeah. So let's talk a little bit about sustainability. And, you know, are there threats down here due to development or pollution? Doesn't strike me. It strikes me as this is pretty well preserved down here.
Everyone here takes sustainability very seriously. You know, we want to have fish all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we have, when that fish's numbers are done, you know, they keep track of it out there. Those guys only have a certain amount of this. After those tags are gone, they're done, which, you know, I hate it for the fishermen, but it makes us start looking outside of the box. You know, fish that, you know, used to be considered throwbacks are now on menus here. You
really?
Know?
Like what?
Anything from, you know, octopus is making a comeback here. We can get some local octopus, you know.
People, really?
Fish, they didn't used to keep it, but now they're keeping it because there's a, you know, we're wanting it now.
Right.
Different things like that, you know. So
somebody was telling me that, you know, when they fish with nets, almost 75% of the fish
goes back.
Sometimes they don't go back, and they just die. And it's because there are hundreds of types of fish, but we maybe only eat 20, and so they're not. I mean, it seems
people are
like
funny. I mean, if they don't recognize the name, they're kind of hesitant about. Well, I don't know. I don't know anything about this fish. You know, do I really want to eat it? You know. Mm-hmm.
So it's the shad is running.
Shad row,
right?
Yeah.
Shad row. And I had some smoked shad last night. Fillet, you know. So
delicious.
That was really great. Do you keep a garden? I know you don't have a dog.
Well,
I'm not going to go there and ask how domestic.
I wouldn't call
all
it a garden.
Do you have a garden with?
But you know, I try to keep herbs growing. I get so frustrated with the darn tomatoes. My mom has always had the best tomatoes, and I always try to, you know, compare my tomatoes to hers, and it just,
What kind of tomatoes does she grow?
You know, I ask her this, and, you know, she'll tell me the variety or whatever, and it doesn't matter. I'll go get the same variety, try to do exactly what she tells me, and I don't know what it is. They still don't taste as good as hers. But what's fun that, well, it could be. And what's so fun for me, though, is as, you know, I was coming, a chef, and coming up and discovering all these great new flavors and stuff, and turned on her own to growing herbs. Like, you know, she never grew basil before. Now she grows like three different kinds of basil. Mm. And then she's got it coming out of her ears. She was like, what am I going to do with all this basil? You know, make some pesto.
Yeah, really.
What's pesto?
Right.
So,
well, if you give me the vegetable soup recipe, I'll give you my pesto recipe.
So now, you know, she's growing herbs. My dad's growing herbs. And he's got his little vegetable garden going, you know, from his patio. Or, you know, I got friends that, you know, we just put in some boxes in his yard, and just recently put in some lettuces and some mustard greens, you know. And I said, that's about all the gardening I'm going to do. And, you know, at least over there, I know somebody else is helping me take care of it.
Do you have some dreams still out there that you want to realize, let's say, in the next 5 years?
Mm.
I said, okay, magic wand time, you just won the lottery, $10 million. You could do anything you want. We're going to give you a sabbatical from the restaurant. What would you do with that?
On the dream side of things, I'd have a little restaurant and a farm that I could just go out there daily and just pick out what was fresh, what was coming from the garden, and cook it that night for whoever was coming in. No menu. This is what the menu is, whatever I pulled in from the garden that day.
What's the ideal size of the restaurant?
Uh-huh.
Like that. In your dream.
probably 30, 40 seats maybe, mm-hmm. you know, a little countertop there, family style tables, mm-hmm. everybody enjoying meeting new people that are sitting beside, passing plates around.
Mm-hmm. What do you be drinking? What's your cocktail?
Oh, a good glass of bubbles is always nice.
I do too.
But you got to have a little bourbon back there too, because I'm a good Southern woman.
Yeah. So, you know, what's the ultimate way? I'm a woman too. Is there a woman's way to drink bourbon?
Proper bourbon would be
straight.
Straight. Maybe one ice cube. That's about it.
Okay. I think I've... Mr. Van Winkle, is it?
Julian
Van Winkle. I met him last night. I'm supposed to try to find a Manhattan with him. You know, the two cultures, let them mix. Miss Manhattan. Miss
Truly,
Manhattan.
Have you had his bourbon yet?
No, I haven't.
What a treat.
It really is.
What a treat.
I guess there's a lot of these artisanal distilleries.
Excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awele, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, the French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.